Midwife calling. Hello, and welcome to Popular Opinion, a Call the Midwife podcast, where we are watching and recapping every episode of Call the Midwife without spoilers. I'm Jan Moffat.
I'm Dr. Paul Moffat, not that kind of doctor, and this week we watched and are talking about the 8th and final episode of Season 8 of Call the Midwife. Final episode except for the Christmas special that comes in between seasons that...
We call that the Season 9, Episode 0 Christmas special.
We do.
We have this debate every time.
This episode was directed by Kate Cheeseman and written by Heidi Thomas. This is Kate Cheeseman's first episode of Call the Midwife, but not her last. Heidi Thomas, we last saw as writer of... She created the show, obviously. Maybe not obvious, but if you know Call the Midwife, Heidi Thomas created the show. The last episode she's credited as the individual writer is the first episode of this season. Heidi Thomas has written... the first and last episode of every season of Call the Midwife, and not just so far, like, even past the ones we have watched. She has written every Christmas special, and she's written the first and last episode of every season, and then sometimes sprinkled inside. Not this season, but just interesting little tidbit. Interesting to me, anyway. Jan, do you want to take us through the recap of this episode?
I sure do. It's interesting that it's Kathy Cheeseman's first episode when it's such a part two of the previous episode. So speaking of which, Mature Jenny narrates about the night and the dawn as we pick up right where we left off with Val outside her grand's home. Later, she and Trixie talk about how they must go to Sister Julianne and the police. Sheila and Patrick are dealing with May's impending move, but also looking to throw a ball as a fundraiser for the maternity home. Sister Hilda visits Julia Schrader, a teenager with cancer, whose mom, Ina, is pregnant. Reggie returns home as there's an outbreak at his institution. Val and Trixie talk to Sergeant Wolfe about Mrs. Dyer, and she is arrested. She has a story ready for the police and claims her innocence. Miss Higgins comes to bring Phyllis her clothes for her discharge, including a card with a sappy poem.
So this episode, as you said, begins immediately after the previous episode ends. Like, the narration, the voiceover narration about night and dawn is symbolic, like, it's thematically relevant to the episode, which is an episode all about hope and, despair and what happens, what's going to happen next. But it's also literally relevant because this is the night that is the same night as the last episode ended, and this episode begins on the same night with Val outside, I think, to watch it again and pay more attention, but I think, like, outside her grandmother's house.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the pub, the room over the pub is her grandmother's
right,
house.
Right, right. This reflection at the beginning about dawn and a dawn that is so dark that dark is seems impossible, that so dark that light seems impossible, or however exactly she says it. She says, hours where grief lives, fear rules, truth is exposed like a wound, hope hides, peace is for others. It kind of reminds me of this poem by Maggie Smith, How Dark the Beginning.
That Maggie Smith or a different Maggie Smith?
A different Maggie Smith.
Okay.
Maggie Smith, who, if you know, if you have heard of her, it is probably for another of her poems, which is called Good Bones, which is the one I talk about the world to my children like a real estate agent going through a house. You could make this place beautiful. It's got good bones. Mm. And then she also has this poem, How Dark the Beginning, that I'm not going to read all of, but it's all about... so many hours between the day receding and what we recognize as morning, the sun cresting like a wave that won't break over us. She puts a spin on it that, like, there's good dark.
Mm.
But it also is about, like, the cliche of it's always darkest before the dawn. But both this voiceover and the Maggie Smith poem stick with the darkness. But like, it's always darkest when it's very, very, very dark and dawn seems like it's never, ever going to come. And this is the emotional state that we see Val certainly in at the beginning of this episode. There's a little bit of tie-in to the Turners, who are dreading the departure of May, but obviously...
And also the girl dying of cancer.
Yeah, well, that we haven't gotten really yet in the voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
But she certainly, thematically, if this is an episode about hope and the lack of hope, like, we'll get to her as we talk about her, but she, her central character note in this episode is that she does not have hope and everyone else is encouraging her to have hope, but she just doesn't have any or see any. While this voiceover is going on, we cut to the nuns in the chapel saying their prayers, singing their Compline prayers, and the psalm that they are singing, we only get a little snippet of it, but enough for me to recognize it as Psalm 26, which is singularly relevant to this episode because it says, it's called, a lot of the Psalms in the Book of Common Prayer, the Psalms are given titles that are based on Latin translations of the first couple of words. And so this Psalm, Psalm 26, is Judere me, meaning judge me. And it's, I'm not, again, not going to read the entire thing, but it says, be thou my judge, O Lord, for I have walked innocently. I will wash my hands in innocency, and so I will go to thine altar. And it is very relevant for a criminal trial episode where Mrs. Dyer refuses to plead guilty, and she is being judged. And this voice, this prayer at the beginning says, God is going to be her judge.
Wow, yeah. I didn't notice that that was the psalm, and that's beautiful. I always love it when they're singing Compline, of course.
Me too. I think, obviously, Heidi Thomas loves it, because a Heidi Thomas-written episode is going to have some of the nuns singing.
So true, so true.
There are a few lines missing right at the beginning of this episode from the cut out from the CBC version. Based on the longer script, that expand a little on Patrick and Sheila are dreading, are expecting to miss May and are gloomy about it.
Yeah.
And it's in that context that Sheila mentions the Ballroom of Hope as like, well, yes, we need to look towards the future. And the future is an incubator for the clinic. And to raise money, we're going to have a Ballroom of Hope. Which is, again, a statement of the theme of the episode is about, you know, one of the themes of the episode is about kind of insisting on hope.
Yeah, hope despite all odds being against you kind of thing.
Yeah.
The beginning with Trixie, it was Val and Trixie. Val, you know, comes home and Trixie finds her staying up all night because she can't sleep, and Trixie's like, he never came to bed. Like, what was I gonna do? Sleep? Like, it's not possible for her to do that, and she's so distraught. The next day, you see her, and like, usually Val, I guess, is like made up, and like, her hair is looking fine, but like, she is so pale, so not wearing her usual makeup. Like, she looks horrible in like that kind of way, you know, like she does not look well, and like everything about her says, like, I feel like good job on the makeup crew for making her look unwell this like entire episode.
No, yeah, it's not just the beginning, the entire episode she is not. I think, like, obviously Jennifer Kirby is wearing makeup because she's an actor, but I think that either Val is wearing no makeup or Val is so distraught that it is showing through her makeup.
Yes.
That, like, the makeup that Jennifer Kirby is wearing is no makeup face for Val. And it really makes her feel, like, particularly, I mean, a little detail of, like, she's not wearing, she usually wears much darker eyeliner, and it makes her eyes so sunken without them in this whole episode. she really looks not just unwell, but like withdrawn. Mm-hmm. I think the like very much less emphasized eyes, very light skin tone that like makes her look pale, and she just looks so much more washed out in the face that makes her look like she has gotten smaller.
Yes, that's a good call. Smaller. So that is the main plot that really overshadows this entire episode, is this thing with Val's Gran and the court case and everything. But there are a few other plots. In fact, this episode is honestly pretty jam-packed with plots. Mm-hmm. So the outside of Nanata's plot is Julie Schrader mm-hmm. and her mother, Ina. I found this family so fascinating. The idea of he's German, and of course this is just post-World War II, and so German is not the most welcome person around, and Julie mentions having the last name Schrader and being teased. And it comes out through the episode that Julie is not his daughter. He married Ina when Julie was 5. And they have now 3 other sons and another on the way. And it just makes for an interesting dynamic through the whole thing of this father's relationship with his daughter. There's a lot of father-daughter relationships in this episode as well.
Mm-hmm.
But she has Hodgman's disease, which is lymphoma, lymph cancer, which even today is not the most curable of cancers because it's in your lymph nodes. So you have to irradiate it, and she's burned with radiation.
Yeah, just to be really explicit, in your lymph nodes, which means it's inoperable. You can't just cut it out.
Exactly.
And it's your lymph nodes spread throughout your body, so it lymphatic cancer tends to spread beyond the lymph nodes because it connects to all the other systems.
Yes, exactly.
So it's before we even meet her, the nurses talking amongst themselves, like, there's this new patient, go see her, she has Hodgkin's, 17, that's awfully young to be dealing with cancer, and there's nothing they can do about it.
Mm-hmm. They're there to just, like, treat the wounds, and that's it.
She's not, her prognosis is prognosis negative.
Yeah, exactly.
So she has burns that are radiation burns from her treatment. She, speaking of makeup and looking sick, like, she looks so pale through the whole episode and, like, dark circles and, mm-hmm. like, clearly unwell from the first time we see her. I agree, this family dynamic is so interesting. They're, like, so many details that, I like that make an episode compelling is unnecessary details.
Yeah, there's no reason that he needs to be German.
No, there's a little conversation that later we'll get to later, but it doesn't need to. You could have done it in lots of different ways. He doesn't have to be German, but the like specific detail, he was a prisoner of war. He married Ina when Julie was 5. We don't ever know what happened to Julie's father, biological father.
No.
But
I assume killed in the war.
Seems plausible, yes.
Yeah.
And there's an early on conversation where, like, I married him when Julie was 5, and Julie and Sister Hilda is like, oh, I bet the two of you became best friends right away.
Mm-hmm.
And Julie is like, something like that.
Yeah. Not
we
so much.
We see right away they are not particularly close. And it does pay off a bit in the episode, but it also just, like, adds so much texture to this family. The mother is played by Carrie Godleman, who we know from Taskmaster.
She's one of the best Taskmaster contestants, I think.
She was on whatever season. I think it was season 4 of
Season seven. I can't remember who else is in it, but it's one of the best seasons.
And she is one of the best she is one of the all-time best Taskmaster contestants because her attitude as a Taskmaster contestant is like, I'm not going to fiddle fart around, I'm just going to do the task.
Bosh.
And so it's fun to see her. Like, that has nothing to do with this episode, except that it's fun to see her in a very different context,
yes,
in a very, as a very different character. I think that this whole family is very compelling,
yeah,
compellingly written and acted, and...
But speaking of her character, she's pregnant, like, quite pregnant, and hasn't seen the doctor.
Yes.
So this is her fifth baby, and she's not, Julie, like, says she's not even eating liver like the other pregnant
moms. She doesn't even knit.
Doesn't even knit.
Everyone in the family way knits. She doesn't even knit. She doesn't stop. She isn't taking care of herself.
Yeah, because she has too many people to take care of, obviously.
And this is a thing, too, that we're setting up that'll pay off a bit more in the episode, but not to give things away, but one of the other things I really like about this episode is that it pays off in small ways, not like in a big dramatic blow-up way. But she's not taking care of herself because she's taking care of everyone else, and particularly Julie.
Yeah.
And she is so focused on taking care of Julie, who is terminally ill, that she is not taking care of herself because she is not prioritizing herself. Which is very relatable, I think, and even reasonable, that, like, I've had four babies before, I'm fine, Julie's the one who needs care.
Yeah, exactly.
The father says, what is his name? Mr. Schroeder.
Can't remember, I don't think I wrote it down.
And he doesn't even play the piano, despite being named Schroeder. He says she hasn't been to the doctor in 6 months. So she's, she doesn't sit down, doesn't eat liver, doesn't knit, hasn't been to the doctor. That's the dynamic there.
We were watching the beginning of this episode together, and she says something like, oh, there's Spam and Pickle on the drain rack for you to have, and you went, Jan's favorite sandwich. Which is not true.
It is.
Canned ham and Spam are not the same thing. I like canned ham and pickle.
This is a total digression in a very interesting episode. We're talking about Spam and Pickle. But Jan, like, back me up here. Jan, when we got married and still, but it was one of the, like, you get married and the wool gets pulled out. the wool over your eyes gets pulled away. And she makes herself, like, canned ham, pickles, and cream cheese, and she stirs it all up together. It's gross.
And puts it's a normal, it's a perfectly normal sandwich that you get at, like, a church function or a tea or whatever, and I like it, and I will eat it and not be ashamed. You made myself feel, made me feel ashamed of liking that sandwich? No, I have canned ham in the cupboard right now.
You can have it.
And I will. More for me.
This is a
digression. Last week we digressed about eugenics. This week it's Spam and Pickle.
It may be other things. You may find other things come to us. There's a little also, like, splash of a moment that builds the story about May, which is just Sheila's making a dress for Angela for this ball that's coming up. And May comes in and says, can I have a dress?
She has a whole line.
She has a whole line. I think it's her first line in this whole series.
Might be.
Can I have a dress? Well, you'll be gone by the time the ball is.
Yeah.
She says, like, you'll be off having so much fun with your mommy and daddy. But it's like, no, because this is for a future you're not included in. Like, that's a sad moment for all of them.
Yeah, exactly.
And for me, watching it, even though I know how this ends,
yep,
they get her back by the end of the episode. Spoiler to the episode. But that, that is a really heartbreaking moment.
It is, absolutely.
The other minor story that starts here is Fred is having bathroom troubles.
Yep, we'll get to that. Just seated early in the episode, it's true. You're always in the bathroom. I can't remember. Do they call it toilet? Do they call it loo? I don't remember.
It was, Reggie is back because there is some, an outbreak of some lung disease at his,
I called it institution, but I don't know exactly. It's like a home. It's not
home.
Institution makes it sound very cold, but it's a good place, supposedly.
So he can't stay because there's an outbreak and he is especially susceptible lungs or whatever. So they send him home. Vi comes in a real panic. They're like, what if the train arrives and we're not there? And they have to rush off to get him. And then Fred's issues come up because he comes out of the bathroom and Reggie's like, you were ages in there. Fred's like, that's very personal. Don't mention it.
Yeah, it's true.
So that's the like context of that.
Yeah.
Reggie is home and Fred is having toilet troubles.
Okay, but the main part of this episode is Elsie Dyer. So let's talk a bit about her. I really want to talk, like, I don't know what more there is to say, but she walks into the police office, so she's arrested. Mm-hmm. They don't cuff her. They just take her in, and she's got her story all ready to go. That, oh, no, she came to me. She was already bleeding. I was just helping her out. Like, she absolutely had her story ready for when she was arrested. She knew that this was a possibility. Of course she did. And it's kind of astounding in a way of like how quickly she can come up with a story because she already had it.
And there's a thing on TV. Often when someone is lying on TV, they have to be a bad liar because the TV show needs us, the audience, to understand that they're lying. So there's a real trope of like, oh, that was my the thing that I got because I needed it, right? And it's implausible that anyone on the screen actually believes them.
Mm-hmm.
Elsie Dyer is lying smoothly.
Yes, exactly.
We know what happened, mm-hmm. but if we didn't know what happened, her story is smooth and plausible and persuasive and emotional. Like, she sells that she is horrified by this girl with blood running down her legs. She sells that she wanted to help her, that she... the girl tried to bring on the miscarriage herself and said sorry to me all the way up the stairs. She blames her
mm-hmm.
for her own... Like, she says that she did it herself.
Yeah.
That it wasn't an accidental miscarriage. That she tried to bring on the abortion herself. She has excuses for the surgical instruments ready. I used that to lance my carbuncles and I was given by doctor's advice. And she sells also, like, why didn't you call an ambulance? Because she was afraid and didn't want police involvement. And she sells that so angrily.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In a really, like, compelling way. Like, she, if you didn't know, I think she sells this story.
Yep, exactly. And so she can protest her innocence, much to Val's sadness, because... that means that Val has to testify against her.
Yeah.
And it's... yeah.
Some stuff that gets said a little bit more explicitly a little later, but we see immediately that she is going to plead not guilty. She has her story. And that means practically that it's going to go to court. There's going to be testimony. And who are the witnesses? Val and Trixie.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have to testify. And so she's part of the weight of this episode is that she didn't just perform illegal abortions. By pleading not guilty, she is putting Val in the position where Val has to choose
mm-hmm.
sides. And that gets said very explicitly a little later, but like Val has to choose whose side she's on. And either lie or put her grandmother behind bars.
The last part of this section is Phyllis is going to be released soon from the hospital and Miss Higgins comes to visit her and it's a patient strong, the whole thing you said last week about patient strong comes to fruition in this moment.
I know. I have seen this episode before, but when we recorded last time, I hadn't seen this episode in years, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't know it was going to pay off so immediately, and vindication for me that Patient Strong matters. Because Miss Higgins gives her this card, and the poem on it... When pastures fresh beckon and new dawns the light, don't rush to be active and pick up the fight. Instead, rest and be thankful you're now almost hale, but let friends support you. Remember, you're frail. That sounds like Patient Strong. That's what Patient Strong's poems sound like. And that Phyllis assumes it's Patient Strong, and Miss Higgins is so, like, flattered and so, like, thrilled that, like, no, I wrote it myself. And it's such a good moment and joke because for Phyllis, this sounds like Patient Strong is clearly an insult.
Yeah, it's not a compliment.
But to Miss Higgins, this poem I wrote sounds like Patient Strong is a huge compliment, and she is just thrilled.
Not only that, but Phyllis being told she's frail is not what she wants to hear. And she mentions sprinting like Ann Packer, which is a reference to the previous episode as well, but she's the woman who won the gold medal for England. So,
are you reading my notes?
I have it in my notes as well.
Okay. Yeah, so Ann Packer, Phyllis, says she's was immobile, not sick,
yeah,
not ill. And so Miss Higgins is bringing her things, not only cards, but also practical things of like, when you come out and you can do light exercise in your recovery. And Phyllis is like, I am immobile, but once they let me out, I am not frail. I am going to be sprinting. And she says, Miss Higgins is like, maybe you'll be on light duty, I'm sure, because you've been ill. You can come and join me on Thursday for this ladies club or whatever it is. And Phyllis is like, I believe you'll find that I will be busy with my work every afternoon, including Thursdays. It's again, like... Phyllis, again, is not exactly rebuffing, but, like, Miss Higgins is making real overtures of friendship, and, Phyllis is not...
It's not the most tactful person.
She's not being... I mean, fair enough that, like, I'm not frail, and I'm going to be at work, and I also don't like Patient Strong.
Yeah.
And she is, like, smiling about it. She does put it with a little bit of, you know, but a little bit of hiding her feelings.
Yeah, but exactly.
As I was saying before about, like, on TV, we have to be able to see through someone's feelings. We, the audience, can tell that Phyllis does not like any of this stuff and is like, okay, Miss Higgins, we are not really very good friends.
Maybe they will be, though. All right, let's move on to our next part.
Take it away.
Val sobs at her grand's door about going to court. Fred and Reggie are both struggling, but Violet doesn't know what it's about. May is taken away to be adopted, to everyone's bittersweetness. Fred accidentally breaks the mirror ball for the dance. Julie is accepting of her fate, but her parents less so. A relative of Val's comes to tell her off at the clinic and has to be chased out by Lucille. Cyril shows up to Nodus and accidentally sees Lucille and Trixie in their underthings, so he's sent off to Violet to purchase sewing supplies. While there, he offers her advice on Fred and Reggie. Sister Hilda chats with Julie, who longs to go to the dance. Sergeant Wolfe finally visits Phyllis and reads Miss Higgins' poem, shifting his affections towards Miss Higgins instead of Phyllis. Fred confesses to Reggie about his bladder, while Reggie confesses that he has a girlfriend.
So there's a little scene that I mentioned earlier, missing from the... or I alluded to earlier. There's a little scene missing from the CBC version where it is very clear that Val has to give evidence against her grandmother, that the... victim and complainant, whatever her name is, the woman who they saw who got the abortion and is sick, is in hospital and can't give evidence.
It doesn't want to.
Doesn't want to and can't.
Mm-hmm.
So she's going to make a written statement. And so the toll case is going to rely. This is like all in the subtext, but there's a scene where they make it all text that we didn't see, where the whole case is going to rely on Trixie and Val. And we see Val's inner conflict play out in this section, like the crying at her grandmother's door.
So well done. Like, once again, Jennifer Kirby does an amazing job, that sobbing at her door, and like, she knows that she's there, I'm going to have to testify, how can you do this to me, kind of attitude it's heart-wrenching to watch.
And then she also has this relative, like, Elsie Dyer may be your grandmother, but she's my mom's aunt. And she's got relatives all over this place, and you don't know whose side you are. Maureen says to Valerie, I thought I was talking to a stuck-up turncoat who's forgotten whose side she's supposed to be on.
Mm-hmm. And she talks about her swanning around with the nuns and, just being a traitor, which is, not what Val needs to hear right now.
Well, and we've seen through the whole time that Val has been on the show, like, she is from Poplar and now a nurse and midwife, and she's kind of made good, and she's this connection between the nuns and nurses and the community, because this is where she is from and born and raised, and she is a real, like, symbol of hope for the community, that, like, you can make good in, like, does her nursing in the community, that, like, she is using her skills and training and education for the good of the place that she's from. And we've seen most of the time until now that, like, this is so beautifully symmetrical. And here we have sides.
Yeah.
And whose side are you supposed to be on? And that is, like, are you on your grandmother's side against the law? Are you on Poplar's side against the nurses? And are you on the working class against the upper class?
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, are you on family's side against institutions?
Yeah.
So, like, whose side is Val on? She's on the side of the medical profession and the law and men and education and stuck-up upper-class, middle-class, educated people. And she should be on the side of working-class women who are working-class poor women of Poplar and her family.
I think the question in all of this is, if Trixie hadn't have been with her, what would have Val done? I think there would have been more of a conflict. I do think that Val knew what her grandmother did was wrong and had also seen what had happened to Kath and to the other woman who died. But I do really question what side she'd be on if she had gone alone.
And there's a real earlier... One of the first things that happens in this episode is Trixie saying to Val, we have to report it.
Mm-hmm.
And Val says, to Sister Julianne? And Trixie says, well, certainly to Sister Julianne, but also to the police.
Mm-hmm.
And Val doesn't argue or disagree, but there is, I think, reason to think that on her own she might not have done that or wanted to or chosen to.
Or had the strength to.
Like, it's an interesting dynamic that Trixie is... And Trixie is also the one who says... Sister Julianne, Val and I need to speak to you. And we don't see that scene, but, like, Trixie drives the reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Val doesn't argue, but she's clearly conflicted and even tormented about it.
Yeah. Which, of course, the woman who comes in doesn't see that, because why would she?
The whose side are you on is an interesting... do you have more to say about Val?
No.
Whose side are you on is an interesting theme in this episode that we said a second ago that there's no particular reason why Mr. Schrader needs to be German. But we have a German prisoner of war in England immediately after World War II in an episode about whose side are you on.
Mm.
And we don't... There's another scene that's going to play that out even more that I don't want to preempt. But even at this point, whose side is he supposed to be on? Like,
I think, to be clear, he was a prisoner of war of the Germans. He wasn't a prisoner of war of the English, I don't think. He's West German, and it seems like he was held by the Germans.
In any case, I am sure if he was a prisoner of war in Germany by the Germans, it's because he was on, from their perspective, the wrong side. And so the theme of whose side are you on, he is on the wrong side for his country at the time. And it's the right side, you know, from England's perspective. And I'm going to just go out and say it. I don't care who's listening. I think the Nazis were the bad guys.
I'm sad that you actually have to say that in almost seriousness.
But he, I don't think it is a conflict for his character, but it is a thematic connection that he represents whose side are you on?
Mm-hmm.
A German now living and married to an English woman in England with a German name.
And she was teased for having a German name in school.
Because this is about, like, how do you know? How do you decide whose side you're on? How can you tell? And what side are you supposed to be on? What Maureen says to Val is, you've got all your medical learning, but blood is thicker than water.
Mm-hmm.
Your loyalty should be to your family. I said we were done with Val, but it's like the same theme going on.
But speaking of Julie, she's dying. But as we said earlier, everyone else kind of has hope or like, wants her to have hope. And she knows she's dying. She knows that she's not going to have a normal life and have children. And like, you know, she wants to help her mother with the new baby because this is her only chance. And she definitely represents that kind of hopeful person who is like hopeful in the face of adversity or like, resolute.
Yeah, resolute.
Is more the word I'm looking for. She's resolute to her fate, but also not sitting there despairing about it either. She wants to do things.
She talks to Lucille and says, like, they told me in the hospital my prognosis.
Yeah.
There's nothing they can do. And Lucille says, no doctor or nurse should ever tell a patient there's nothing they can do. And Julie says, even if it's true?
Yeah.
And she is sad.
Mm-hmm.
She plays it, like, sad.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's not, like, overcome with despair. She's more frustrated. What we see more is her being frustrated that no one will talk to her honestly about mm-hmm. what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
That her mother, there's a little conflict early on of, like, she hates the smell of hospitals. It'll be hard to get her in next time. And Julie says, like, what if there's not a next time?
Mm-hmm.
By which Julie means, I'm going to die before you take me back to the hospital because I am terminally ill. And Ina says, the only reason there won't be a next time is if you're so cured, you don't even have to go to the doctor. Like,
mm-hmm. She's in denial.
She's in denial. And that comes back to, like, she isn't taking care of herself because she's in denial about that, too. And
mm-hmm.
it's a different face of denial, but like she is focusing all her care on Julie, but also can't face the reality of what Julie actually needs, and she also can't bring herself to care for herself to do the thing that does need doing.
Mm-hmm.
Not that caring for Julie doesn't need doing, but like, yeah, she's in denial.
Mm-hmm. But Julie gets to go or prepares to go to the dance. I love Sister Hilda's attitude that, like, it'll be just what the doctor ordered. She's very pro Julie going to the dance.
And she says, Julie says, oh, Okay, first, Julie says, I've always wanted to go to a dance. I was too young, and then I was too ill, and now it's now.
Mm-hmm.
And just, like, she has never been to a dance.
Yeah.
And then, so she doesn't know how to dance. Sister Hilda says, I'll teach you how. I was a dab hand at the foxtrot before I took the veil. And I love Sister Hilda, all the little glimpses at, like, what was Sister Hilda's life like before she became a nun?
Her, I also want a little, like, prequel series about, of, like, what? Sister Hilda, before she was a nun, did all kinds of fun things. She was, like, she was a tomboy, I imagine. Like, she was really...
Well, I don't know, because she joined the RAF
for the nylons. Oh, yeah, to get nylons. That's true, to get nylons. I forgot.
She joined the RAF for the nylons, and she was a dab hand at the foxtrot.
No, she wasn't. She was the opposite of a tomboy.
Yeah, exactly.
She was, like, a girl about town, and then decided to take the veil, and why? Oh, I would love to, like, get that whole backstory.
It is another example of Heidi Thomas's good writing of, like, unnecessary details.
Yes, exactly.
That make her... such a compelling character in ways that, like, she seems lived in. She mm-hmm. seems like a real person who didn't start to exist when she came on screen. These little details that she was a dab hand at the foxtrot, I love. And the way that she even says it, like, yeah. I love that line. Julie is going to go to the dance. It'll be, you know, she getting out of the gloom and despair of her imminent death
mm-hmm.
is, like, just what the doctor ordered for her. Yeah. And it symbolizes... I mean, it's on the nose, too on the nose. Like, she's going to go to the Ballroom of Hope.
Yeah.
And dance.
Yeah.
17-year-old terminally ill dancing at the Ballroom of Hope.
It reminds me of the children's hospital that we go to sometimes has the Garden of Hope for the kids with cancer outside there. Like, things are called that in cancer wards.
They are.
Of things about hope. Speaking of extreme sadness, May is taken away, and honestly, the image from this episode of little May waving out at the back of that window to them all sticks with me.
Yeah.
Stuck with, like, I knew going into this episode, I was like, I'm pretty sure this is the one where May is waving goodbye from the back of the window, and it's heartbreaking. And they're all trying to be, like, really positive. Everybody there is, like, got their, like, best faces on, but as soon as she's actually gone, it's crying.
Yeah.
It's hard. We've known a lot of, just by virtue of the friends we have and church we go to, I've known a lot of kids in foster families and in foster care, and it's always, like, such a wonderful thing when they get their, you know, forever home, but sometimes that means leaving forever and leaving the foster parents that they've been with. And we've seen kids who are with foster parents for 6 and 7 years, and then they are adopted, and it's wonderful, but it's also heartbreaking, even just, like, as, like, my friend's kids, foster kids, I'm going to miss those kids. I do miss those kids. And it's tough for literally everyone.
Yeah.
I wish there was better systems, but it's hard to imagine how to...
What to do.
Yeah.
On a lighter note, Cyril shows up at the door. There's a box full of stuff outside that he brings in for the dance, and he comes in, and Trixie and Lucille are, like, sewing dresses, and so they are in their undergarments in the kitchen, and Sister Monica Joan leads him in, and he walks in, and they're shrieking. I think it's just Lucille and Trixie, maybe Val too. But anyway, they all, like, shriek and hide behind curtains and, like, what are you doing here? And my favorite part of the whole scene is Sister Monica Joan, and delivered with, like, such perplexed sadness. None of them were déshabillés when I was summoned by the bell. Déshabillés. French for undressed.
Yeah.
It's just what I love it. I love this moment. It is so funny.
It is so funny.
And Sister Monica Jones' reaction is my favorite part of this. Like, I don't know what is happening here.
Yeah, exactly.
And Lucille, of course, is especially
embarrassed
because it's her boyfriend walked in on her in her underwear.
Yeah. So then Cyril goes to Vi's to buy like whatever notions and stuff they need for sewing, and Vi confides in him, and the two of them have a heart-to-heart talk, and I feel like Cyril and Violet is the weirdest character combination. When has Violet ever before spoken to Cyril on this show? Like, I've never ever seen them interact before. And like, we're like, you know, they're both main characters of this TV show, but what reason would he ever have to, she ever have to interact with him?
Fred and Cyril know each other before the show starts.
Okay.
Before Cyril's a character, he's recommended by Fred.
Okay.
That's still a pretty weak connection.
Yeah.
I do think, like, he just happens to be who's there when she breaks down.
Yes, I think that's true.
But that's still a writerly choice and a weird one.
It's a very odd pairing.
And his
at this point.
His advice to her that is, like, fine, I guess, it works in the episode, is,
yeah,
like, Fred's acting weird and Reggie's acting weird. You should get them to talk to each other and stay out of it.
Yeah. Let men be men.
Let men be men. Okay, sure.
Sure.
It works in the episode. I think it's kind of dumb.
Yeah, I agree.
Also, I mean, like, yeah, anyway, Fred is acting weird. I mean, it's pretty obvious that there's something physically up with Fred.
Yeah, exactly.
It's obvious to the viewers, anyway. But he's not confiding in Val. Mm-hmm. I mean, Vi. He's not confiding in Violet because he's embarrassed.
Yeah. I mean, they're only, like, it's not like this is, like, a marriage that they've been together a long time, and so all of their physical ailments are very out there.
4 years.
4 years.
He says 4 years of marriage.
Yeah, but I mean, I still feel like, as someone who's been married for 20 years, I feel like there's different things about being their age if they had been married from young to
yeah.
now, and it was like their 40-year marriage. You almost have no secrets to that in that kind of way. The fact that they've only been married 4 years is like they're still a little honeymoonish. He doesn't want to talk about his prostate in front of his wife, you know, like,
yeah, fair enough.
And being of a certain generation as well, all that stuff.
The last thing in this little section, Sergeant Wolf comes to visit Phyllis in the hospital. He says, please, Aubrey, when I'm wearing my sport coat.
Yeah, we definitely did not know his name before this.
His name is Aubrey.
Aubrey. I really like the name Aubrey. It's become very, like, traditionally, it's a very male name, and it's become, my brain is not filling in the blank. Unisex. It's become a unisex name. Like, I've met both men and women named Aubrey now.
I think it is because it sounds like Audrey.
It sounds like Audrey, basically. But I had an uncle, did I say this? I had an uncle named Aubrey, or a great uncle named Aubrey, and I always kind of liked that name. So it's a little, but it always sounds just a little bit girly.
So Sergeant Wolf is Aubrey. Don't call me Sergeant when I'm in my sport coat. He brings a card from the Cub Scouts, and Phyllis sees an opportunity.
She sure does.
And she recommends, like, Miss Higgins made her own card. You should read that. And Sergeant Wolf is so impressed by the choice of poem that she chose such a good Patient Strong poem. He recognizes Patient Strong's poetry. No, it's not Patient Strong. Miss Higgins wrote that herself. And he is impressed. And there is a real possibility that Sergeant Wolf and Miss Higgins may fall for each other and take each other out of Phyllis's hair.
Yep.
They both have, like, more affection for Phyllis than she wants.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
If they can tunnel that towards each other.
Yes, this is, like, perfect. I love this moment so much.
Yeah. They do. I said last plot, but Reggie and Fred do go out together.
Yeah.
Violet
gives them money to
go to the pub. Reggie is to have only cider, which is alcoholic, which is like, but anyway, they go to the pub and they have man talk and they, share, Reggie misses his girlfriend and Fred says, I'm having a bit of trouble in my old waterworks, but you fixed the tap in the, I mean down below my bladder. And Reg, I love Reggie's like, oh, go to the doctor.
Exactly.
It's just like, oh, beat, go to the doctor. That's your solution, Fred. No, I don't want to go to the doctor. Like, I just love the, there's a simple solution, Fred. Here it is. And that's the, like,
that's the end. And Reggie has a girlfriend.
And Reggie has a girlfriend whose name is Jane.
And that's all that Fred finds out, much to Vi's annoyance.
We keep saying Val when we mean Vi, or Vi when we mean Val.
Whoops.
I do. You did it once, but I've done it like 7 times.
All right, let's move on. The trial for Mrs. Dyer looms, with trouble finding enough people to testify. Ina Schrader goes into labor, and Julie is by her side as her daughter is born. Meanwhile, Mr. Schrader wonders how he can be a father to Julie. Fred is seen by Dr. Turner and finds out it's not what he had feared. Before the dance, May's adoption is canceled and she's returned to the Turners. Phyllis returns to Nanatus just in time to send Val and Trixie off to the courthouse. Julie needs a blood transfusion and worries she won't make it to the dance. Trixie takes the stand, but is not able to include Jeannie's story as part of her testimony. Sister Frances and Sister Monica Joan convince Kath to testify against Mrs. Dyer, and she does. The plea is then changed to guilty, and she's sentenced to 6 years. We end with the dance. Mr. Schrader has repaired the mirror ball, and he dances with Julie. Dr. Turner dances with Angela and May together, and Reggie's girlfriend, Jane, arrives to dance with him.
Let's talk about May's story first. Like, let's get that.
Mm-hmm.
She, we've had this tearful goodbye, and then they hear that her adoption has fallen through, and they've sent her back to the mother house. They've sent her back to the orphanage.
Yeah.
Because the father had a relapse and they don't feel they can care for her. And it like, and that's the end, it seems like. It's not delayed. It's like, they're not going to take her. And I absolutely love this moment when they're in the clinic. Sheila comes running in. Patrick, May's adoption has fallen through. And she's at the mother house. Was mother Mildred going to say? Oh, she's had a lot to say about it. And Ms. Higgins says, well, do you have enough petrol in your car?
Yeah, like, go and go now. That's, like, I love that moment, too. She says exactly what needs to be said, which is, go and get her. And they do. And when they do, May gets her second line in this episode. She gets to say, home.
They say, do you know where you are? And she says, home. Mm-hmm. And this is in a... different register, but this is also on the theme of whose side are you on and where do you belong?
Yes.
That, like, why is May's story thematically connected to other things going on is because it's not so much, I said, whose side are you on, but, like, who do you belong to and where do you belong? And the weight of, do you know where you are? Not, I'm in your house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm home.
Yeah, exactly.
It's simple but very moving, I think.
Also, poor May is, like, as they've talked about all along, gonna be kind of traumatized by this.
Yeah, that, like, no, she has been abandoned over and over. Before the Turners took her, she's been abandoned over and over, and now from her perspective, the Turners abandoned her, the people who were gonna take her abandoned her, the Turners took her back, but are they, how, for how long?
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully the, I think, symbolic meaning of her saying that she's home means that she believes that that's where she's going to stay.
Yeah, exactly.
We also have, in terms of home, there's a conversation with Mr. Schrader and Sister Hilda about how Mr. Schrader can be a good father to Julie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I said earlier about whose side are you on? Even though he is West German and prisoner of war by the Germans, is a real interesting choice to have a German character talking about the hardships of Germany before World War II. Not that that isn't a real hardship, but like, not that it, I don't want to say like it's a bad choice or even a surprising choice, but like he talks about the inflation and poverty in Germany, and the loaf of bread costs 200,000 million marks, and it is not framed. Usually, I feel like when we hear conversations about inflation in Germany, it is as a implicit or sometimes explicit apology for Hitler. That like, well, but why did the Germans support Hitler? Because there was inflation. That's not what we're doing here, but we are giving a perspective of like the enemy and sympathy for the enemy. I just think it's an interesting thematic choice within this episode. And he talks about his sister, the cost of bread being so much, and they were starving, and his sister, 5 years old, died on his shoulder. And then when he came to England, Julie was 5 years old. And so this, like, connection between... Mm-hmm.
And he thought that she'd need him as much because she was so well-fed and plump and all those things and didn't need his love in the same way.
Yeah. There's a... Also, you said he fixes the mirror ball. That's not actually on screen. I guess it's he's a glazier. Even in the script that we have, there's no reference to him fixing the mirror ball, but it seems like the mirror ball gets broken by Fred. They mention to him that the mirror ball is broken and there can't be a dance without it. And then there is a dance with a mirror ball. I'm like, how did that get there? Maybe the glazier fixed it. I feel like it's a real shame that that is missing, because he doesn't want Julie to go to the dance because he wants her to preserve her strength. And him fixing the mirror ball is symbolic of, like, I'm going to encourage you to find this, to have this joyful experience and not preserve your strength. Mm-hmm. And I feel it's a real loss to take that scene out. I don't know where it got cut. It's not, there's no dialogue that refers to it in the script. Maybe it's a shot that got cut out that exists in another, in the longer version. But Julie does get her blood transfusion and does get to go to the dance. And we end her story with a father-daughter dance with mm-hmm. her and Mr. Schrader. We didn't really talk about, while we're talking about the Schraders, in between this stuff that we've said, Ina has her baby.
Mm-hmm. It's a daughter after all the sons. So her children are kind of bookended by daughters.
And there's not a whole lot, there's not a whole lot I have to say about that birth, except that Julie is there helping.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dynamic has been that Ina doesn't take care of herself because she's taking care of Julie. And here in her laboring, Julie is there taking care of her.
Mm-hmm.
But Julie doesn't get a miraculous cure. No. We don't end the episode with, oh, her cancer's in remission. Oh, they've discovered a cure for cancer in this 1964. Like, she is still terminally ill, and this dance is probably her last dance, her one and only dance. Mm-hmm. And, like, there, when she goes off to get her blood transfusion, Ina bursts into tears, and Sister Hilda says, she'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
And Ina says, but not forever.
Yeah.
Well, she doesn't say it like that. She says it sobbingly.
Yeah.
But she won't be back forever.
Yeah.
And Sister Hilda says, no, she won't. Yeah. Her life won't be normal. She won't be back forever. She's not going to get better. That brings me a bit into another of the stories that I want to kind of deal with. I mean, this one ties into the abortion trial. And I kind of wanted to deal with all the little strands before we got into it, but I feel like we have to connect this, that Sister Frances is in the chapel dusting and praying, and Sister Monica Joan comes in and says, "I cannot discern whether you are dusting or at prayer. Whichever should be the case, I deduce that you are not succeeding." And Sister Frances says, "Will I get better at it?" And Sister Monica Joan says, "From experience, I would advise that you will not. But you will become more patient, and therein no true grace." I love this moment of, am I going to get better at it? No. We are so used to, and it's partly like Sister Monica Joan, senile and wacky, but I don't think so, actually. I think this is Sister Monica Joan being extremely lucid, giving real wisdom of age. Not sometimes she gives, like, airy-fairy wisdom of she's, like, magical, senile insight, but I think this is an elder nun with real wisdom, and her real wisdom is, no, you won't get better. And it's the same as what Julie is hearing. No, you won't get better. We are so used to the lie.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you'll get better. Oh, it all gets easier. It all gets better. Mm-hmm. And
you just need to try harder.
You need to try harder. You need to be, you know, your faith needs to be better. You need to follow your exercises more and you'll get better. But, like, no amount of doing her exercises or eating her toast is going to cure Julie's cancer. And no amount of, I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily true, but, like, Sister Monica Joan is saying, years of experience are not going to make you better at praying than you are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Or dusting.
Or dusting. That might
be. But you will become more patient and therein no grace, which is what you were saying about Julie is not hopeful exactly. What she is resolute.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, grace for Julie comes in, like, resolutely facing the fact that she won't get better.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, spiritually, Sister Frances, you're not going to become a better person. You're not become better at praying. You're not going to become more holy. You are the person that you are, but you will learn patience.
Mm-hmm.
And experience grace that you don't have to be, like, spiritually, you don't have to be better for God to accept you, is what Sister Monica Joan is saying about grace.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to be a better daughter, Julie, for your father to love you. You don't have to need him differently. And you don't have to get healthy to go to a dance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of this, I love this moment in this episode and this theme in this episode that you won't get better, but that's okay.
Yeah. Sister Frances, I didn't say it a lot in my recap, but Sister Frances is struggling to cope with the whole abortion moment from episode one and from and now the trial. And she has a chance to talk about Kath and about the whole situation. And it's really, I love her whole monologue that she gives. And that also gives her the strength to do what no one else has done and go and find her. And
there's a little also lost from our version, a couple of lines where Sister Monica Joan, Sister Frances says, Sister Julienne said not to talk about it anymore. And Sister Monica Joan says, well, which one of us are you going to obey? I'm older.
I did not. That's really funny.
I am older, and my orders are urgent, and we're going to go see Kath right now.
Yeah.
So it's Sister Monica Joan brings Sister Frances to see Kath.
Which, I just got to say, they go to see Kath's sister at first to find out where she is, and she says she hasn't seen her since it all happened, and Kath has gone out west. Now, I assumed when someone says that they've gone out west, they've
British
gone
Columbia.
To, like, no, they've gone to, like, America, maybe. Like, she went, like, to the western part of England. Like, where is out west? No, out west is, like, literally, like, the western part of London. They go and find her. And, like, to be fair, nowadays, it still takes, like, an hour to get across London, or more, to get across London. And back then, they didn't have the roads that they do now, and so it would take, you know, several hours for them to get to her. So it is a big deal, but it's just hilarious that, like, when someone says out west, I do not think
same city,
the western part of the same city we are in.
And I haven't seen her in months.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, like, they don't have cars.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, there are cars. Phyllis has a car, but most of these people don't seem like cars are not
common.
Yeah,
they have public transport.
They have public transport, and if there's not public transport to the West End easily, if it's a 4-hour trip on public transport, well, they haven't seen each other.
Yep.
Yeah, it is wild that they're in the same city still.
It's like, just, we live in a small city, so it's hard to, like,
live in a city where you can walk from one end to the other in a couple hours.
Yeah, that's true. If you're
motivated,
I was gonna say motivated, there's a lot of hills, but you could drive from one end to the other, like, 20 minutes from the tip top of the end of the St. John's to the other side.
Yeah,
you could, yeah, in traffic it might take you half an hour.
Yeah. Well, I just walked to, we live pretty close, but I walked to the ocean from, you know, downtown.
Yeah.
It was about a 30-minute walk.
Yeah.
The other direction is probably 4 times further.
Yeah.
So, a couple hours.
I was imagining north-south.
Yes,
you're talking east-west.
I'm talking east-west. There's a tiny little thing to mention before we really get into the trial, which is Fred doesn't have prostate cancer.
We didn't mention that before, too. But that's why he didn't want to see the doctor, is he's been reading Sister Julianne's medical books, to which Dr. Turner is like,
she's a midwife.
She's a midwife.
are not in need of a midwife.
Yeah. And he thought he had prostate cancer, which is hilarious. But no, he just has an infection. Go to the doctor, dudes. Go to the doctor.
I was like, I don't know, thematically, like, sometimes you do get better. I don't know.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. It's just Fred being Fred.
Let's talk about the trial.
Okay, let's talk about the trial. Go ahead.
They go to the trial, Trixie and Val, and Sister Julianne goes with them to go and testify at the trial. There is some more conversation, some more lines about, some more emphasis on Val being conflicted. She has to give evidence. And if she gives evidence, she's, as she says, if she does a good job, she's going to put her own grandmother behind bars. And Sister Julianne says, this is also in a cutscene, Sister Julianne says if Mrs. Dyer would plead guilty, it wouldn't be necessary. And so, like, who is, it is Elsie's insistence that she's not guilty that is making all of this have to happen, that is putting Val through this, but also if she pleads guilty, she's gonna go to prison. And Trixie gives evidence first, and she, I think, gives very compelling evidence, including talking about a young woman from Poplar got streptococcus and died after a botched abortion. The defense lawyer says, like, how do you know about that? It was a friend of yours? Well, you're not acting very professional, which I'm going to say I think is really stupid. I think that's a stupid exchange, because she says it's a friend of hers. Maybe that was a mistake on Trixie's part, but, like, she also knows that story in her capacity as a district nurse. So that is relevant.
Yeah, I agree.
Professionally. And that, like, why is I just don't think, like, I think it's stupid.
I agree. It doesn't make sense, but regardless, she's able to testify, like, she had, there were rat droppings as well as blood on the floor, is a line that really sticks with me.
Yeah. and that she knows that Mrs. Dyer has an infectious skin disease.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, she defended having these medical influence from lancing her carbuncle. And when we make it really clear, Trixie makes it really clear, like, that is an infectious skin disease that you are using this medical... I think she probably is using them to lance her carbuncle.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you are using those same instruments on these women. Like, it's a dirty and contagious environment.
Mm-hmm.
And Elsie seems fairly unrepentant.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kath comes in and gives her testimony.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
Well, she tells, you know, she finally tells the whole truth of the story. And I think what affects Elsie is this, like, person that she did this to lost her chance to have any children, lost...
Says she has a 10-inch scar on her stomach. Yeah. It says, she says, what else?
It's that she came to her for help and she didn't help her. And what I find interesting is that Elsie is so affected by Kath's testimony when she killed Jeannie.
Yeah.
Like, she murdered Jeannie. I'm sorry, but, like, that's worse.
But she doesn't
see, like, if Jeannie's husband got up there and testified, that might have also made a difference, but that wasn't going to happen, I guess.
Because Elsie's perspective all along had been, I am doing my best to help, and I help in the best way that I can, and if it doesn't work out, that's out of my hands, and I am trying to help. And Jeannie died, but people die in life.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it's seeing that Kath blames her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? Not that, like, someone else, because someone else said that they shouldn't have gone to her in the first place, but they did go to her because they wanted to. And Elsie's defense in her own mind is, like, judgmental people who should be helping these women and aren't are... you know, accusing them and me, and them and me are on the same side, and we together are against these people who are putting up these legal barriers against something that's necessary, and I am helping these women, and if it doesn't work out, we together, like, it's the women and me together. And so Kath accusing her, Kath blaming her, makes it clear that it is not her and Kath against the law, it's Kath and the law against her, and that changes things for her.
Agreed.
It's all about whose side are you on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she, because Kath testifies, Val does not need to testify.
Mm-hmm.
Because Elsie changes her plea to guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And she is sentenced to 6 years in prison. Which is a long time.
Yeah, especially for an older woman. Yet, I also really believe that she murdered Jeannie, so I don't think 6 years is enough in some ways. But I also don't... Yeah, I don't believe in that kind of justice in general. But it feels too much and not enough.
They say Val and Elsie have this conversation in the jail cell where Val says, you know, 6 years, that's almost the maximum. And Elsie says they took some time off for my age because the light in that courtroom wasn't very flattering. And one of the things that Elsie says is the way the world works, a toss of a coin deciding whether you get what you want or what you deserve. And she recognizes that this 6 years in prison is what she deserves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we agree.
Kind of, yeah. It's, like we said last week and this week too, is like, it's complicated and it's cured by making abortion legal.
And she says, like, until you educated women get together with politicians and change the law, people are going to keep doing this. Mm-hmm. I find that half convincing. I don't love that she throws it on Val until you do something about it. Like,
Val is doing lots about it.
Val is doing so much about it.
Yeah, she is the one out there helping women every day, all day, every day.
So, like, throwing it on Val until you educated lot, again, whose side are you on?
Mm-hmm.
That this whole episode has been about, is Val on her grandmother's side? And this ending is her grandmother on Val's side?
Yeah.
Like, who is on Val's side?
Yeah.
Nanata's house is on Val's
side.
Sister Julianne is on. I mean, like, that wasn't a rhetorical question, and it has an answer, and it's Sister Julianne is on Val's side. And who is on Jeannie's side? Trixie is.
Mm-hmm.
And who is on Kath's side? Sister Frances and Sister Monica Joan are. Not, like, Elsie is not on Kath's side or Jeannie's side or Val's side.
No.
Any last?
No, I just been we finish off the whole episode on the up note with the dance and with Reggie's girlfriend showing up, and he gives her, you know, one of the plants that he's planted, which was very sweet. And all the fathers dance with their daughters. Dr. Turner gets to dance with May and Angela at the same time.
Yeah.
And it ends on a high note, I feel like. And it's a good end to the series. So the season as a whole is this kind of happy dance time.
And I really like, I'm going to come back to a thing I've said often before, is that sometimes this show has trouble threading the needle between maudlin and saccharin. That, like, I feel like this episode does, I feel like Heidi Thomas does,
mm-hmm.
thread that needle that, like, Elsie is going to prison for 6 years, Jeannie is still dead, Julie is still going to die, like, the justice does not help things, and the better relationship with her father does not cure her, but we live, we have the moment that we have, and we find the joy and hope in it, and that's how you live, is not by, hope does not mean pretending that things are going to be fine when they aren't. It means finding the light in the moment that you're in.
And that would have been a perfect voiceover for the end of this episode, Paul.
Yeah, I don't think the voiceover at the end is the best. It's fine.
It's fine. What is your favorite part of this episode?
My favorite part is Sister Monica Joan telling Sister Frances that she's not going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear, I'm sure, when I talked about it, that I think that is an emotional center of the episode. And it is so... It's one of these moments that sometimes happens on the show where it's not faux profound, it's actually profound.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an actually profound moment.
Mm-hmm.
My second favorite, I'm going to say, if you don't say it, I'll say it, but I'll give you a chance. What's your favorite part?
I have a hard time picking one because there's a lot in this episode to love. I think it's Miss Higgins saying, do you have enough petrol in your car? Mm. Of her just, like, preemptively saying, you know, go and get that little girl. Like, I'll do whatever I can in this clinic. She doesn't even hesitate to send the doctor away to do that.
My second, my runner-up that I, if you don't take it, I'll take it as a second one, is Cecil walking in on them in their underwear. Cyril rocking in them in their underwear, and Sister Monica Joan saying, none of them were déshabillés. It's another Sister Monica Joan moment. And I guess I love Sister Monica Joan in this episode. But none of them were déshabillés when I was summoned by the bell. I like, that made me laugh so hard. If you have a favorite moment from this episode and you want to share it with us.
Or want to talk to us about the season as a whole.
Or want to share your least favorite episode or moment in this episode if you don't think that Sister Monica Joan is funny. You can tell us. We'll listen. How would you do that, Jan?
You can email us, poplar@clockworksacademy.com. You can contact us on Blue Sky and mostly our Discord, which will be linked in the show notes, is a nice place to chat with us. You can also support us on patreon.com/clockworkscast, where it will help us get our sound a little better.
we are coming, not coming to, we have come to the end of the season. Mm-hmm. You should expect an episode on the Christmas special in a few weeks, not next week. We'll take a week or two off. If you would like to share a birth story with us for us to read during the interim between seasons, please do, and you can do that by sending it to us in any of those ways that Jen just mentioned. Thank you so very much for joining us this episode and this season. I have been Dr. Paul Moffat.
I've been Jan Moffat, and that's just my popular opinion.
The mother, by the way, is played by Carrie Gondelman, who we know...
Gondelman.
That's what I'm saying.
You're saying Gondelman.
Gondelman.
Cut all this out.
The mother is played by Carrie Gondelman.
I'm gonna lose it on you.